8. Tonight we're going to be focusing on two very timely topics, auto insurance reform and road funding. And I believe, have I unmuted James Homan?
Yep.
Road funding, you go first.
All right. Well, so there I was in doing some of the background for this presentation. I was just looking at some of the numbers and realized that there are enough lanes of roads in Michigan to span the earth 10 times over. Now, the job of organizing and maintaining this system falls onto state lawmakers. Roads are how people get around, and with states and local, or with the state and local governments owning these assets, it is lawmakers' responsibility to ensure that they remain in good working order. So I'm going to cover how we pay for roads right now. I'm going to talk about what the trends in road funding have been, and what the debate will look like for next year.
So, all right, James, let me just chime in one thing. For those who have not been on recently or not been on before, Alt-H opens the chat window. If you have questions, James, now or for Michael later, please type your questions in there and we will get to them at the end of the presentation.
All right. So most roads are maintained by county road commissions, but they tend to be the roads that receive the least amount of traffic. And here's a table on lanes and ownership of Michigan roads. So it shows both lane miles and centerline miles. So if you drive a mile down a highway that has two lanes going in each direction, you traveled one centerline mile, but there's four lane miles. Now, the state maintains 30,000 lane miles worth of trunkline roads, which are the US, I, and M designated roads. And these constitute around 10% of the roads, but they wind up carrying over the half of all of the traffic in the state, including 70% of heavy truck traffic. So this volume of traffic makes it important to consider, since fixing these roads can have an oversized benefit, even though they are also the more costly roads to fix. Now, we pay and maintain these roads using a simple model by whatever's available. Sometimes it is through taxes levied on fuel and vehicle registration, which tends to fall on people who use the roads, but other resources are used as well. And so let me talk a little bit about the idea of user fees, which is overviewed on this next slide. Now, most infrastructure in the country is financed under user fee principles. Communication lines get paid through through phone bills. Sewers get paid with water fees. Oil pipelines get paid by pipeline fees. And user fees have some appealing features. There's an angle of fairness to them. That is, the people who use it are the ones who pay for it. And if you don't use it, you're not paying for it. And they can be efficient. They help people make decisions about whether the costs to use infrastructure are worth it. But this is not how we pay for roads. Instead, roads are funded via imprecise user taxes and whatever resources voters and lawmakers make available for them. Now, what do I mean? There's a portion of road funding that looks like user fees, and there's a lot that does not. And I highlight the sources we use to fund roads in our next slide. Fuel and registration taxes generally fall on people who use roads, but they're not exactly user fees. Vehicle registration taxes are not based on how much you use the roads, but rather on the value of vehicles. Fuel taxes are a little bit better, but reflect people's vehicle choices just as much as it does their road usage. And even with these user taxes, we collect revenue from them, but it doesn't all go to the road system. 10% of both of these taxes goes to support transit subsidies. And you can argue about the virtues of having well-funded transit systems, but that's definitely not road use. If anything, it's encouraging more wear and tear on roads from subsidized users. Now, federal funding can be user fee-like, given that some of it comes from the federal gas tax, but the federal government transfers more than what they collect in revenue, and what is funded by federal deficits is definitely not a user fee. And states receive money not based on use or need, but based on formulas determined through a political process. Now, there are some road funding sources which are explicitly not user fees. So there are over 600 different local government property tax millages approved of by local voters that are dedicated to roads. These fall on people based on the value of their homes, which is not a good indicator for road usage. Local government officials can also dedicate whatever of their own revenues they feel are prudent to spend on the roads that they own. Now, some townships even have millages to improve roads in the townships, even though townships don't own roads. They instead make transfers to their county road commission with the revenue they raise from those dedicated millages. Now, the state is also scheduled to spend $600 million from the state income tax on roads, and lawmakers found another $400 million from other sources besides fuel and registration tax dollars. Oh, and the federal or the state government sometimes goes into debt in order to pay for the roads. This means that today's taxes are going to yesterday's road repairs, and this is just another loosening of the user fee idea. Now, I'm spending so much time on this for a simple reason. Some people want to separate the state road funding decision from all other fiscal consideration, and that's just not how road funding works. It's part of the negotiated budget, it receives as much money as lawmakers find for it, and residents themselves don't have special tolerances for fuel and vehicle registration taxes compared to other taxes, even when these taxes are spent on roads. So, this next chart has all the money that goes to state transportation funding, and this is from last year, since this year is going to be weird with the pandemic going on. And as you can see, more than the majority comes from those loose user taxes, and then other parts come from everything else. Now, this funding is up a lot over the past decade, which is in this slide. State spending was around $2 billion annually on roads from 2001 to 2011, which you can see on this next slide. Now, this $2 billion annual allotment meant that inflation was eating away at what those dollars could accomplish. After that, lawmakers made it a point to spend more in the transportation budget, shown on this next slide. Mm-hmm. Now, funding increased steadily from 2011 to 2019. In fact, state road funding increased from $2 billion in 2011 to $3.6 billion in 2019, which is a 61% increase when adjusted for inflation. But this last year, funding took a little bit of a hit, which is shown here. Now, this was because of a dispute, which I will talk about in a little bit. I mean, I think the big question is, where did we get the money to increase road funding this much? And through what I've kind of been implying this whole presentation, it came from whatever resources lawmakers found for these purposes. They generally found more money by making it a priority for the growth of the state, of the state's tax revenue in the early 2010s. Then they put a tax hike on the ballot in 2015 that would have gone to roads and other priorities. And after that was rejected by voters, lawmakers approved an earmark of some income tax dollars to the transportation budget and increased fuel and vehicle registration taxes. Legislators have appropriated more money than that in the years after, and this is part of annual budget debates. Now, the goal for road funding should be to put the roads together faster than they fall apart, to maintain those levels until we get to an optimum replacement level where road quality is generally at high levels, we can do cost savings, capital project maintenance, and we have the resources to replace roads as they reach the end of their depreciable lives. And we're already at replacement level funding, which is shown on this next slide. There we go. According to the state's Transportation Asset Management Council, our current spending levels keep roads at a similar quality for the foreseeable future. This means that it won't take us much more resources to get us to that goal of putting them together faster than they fall apart. And so after a decade or more of dire warnings from transportation officials, we are close to what should be our goal. Now, one more thing about funding levels. They're not the only thing that matters. Road costs matter too, and costs are up. Road builders report a tight labor force, large increases in the cost of acquiring property when they need it, and increases in the cost of road building materials like sand and gravel. And now, at least that was the case until the pandemic hit. I'm really not sure where it stands now. But we've substantially increased road funding over time, and these cost trends have diluted the effect that funding gains have on road quality. Beneficial cost trends would help us just as much as road repairs, and cost trends matter to road conditions just as much as revenue. Now, what lawmakers can do about costs is a complicated question, but it's worth considering. So, for instance, I know gravel people get a lot of pushback from local property owners when they try and open new gravel pits. And resolving those conflicts can affect how far our road funding dollars will go. So while lawmakers put more money into the budget over the past decade, and this has helped the state get to road replacement level road funding, the current road funding debate has changed. And I've overviewed the conflict, which is pretty basic, on this next slide. So despite there being broad bipartisan agreement that the state should put the roads together faster than they fall apart, and agreement that this requires more spending, the dispute over how to do it has derailed progress. It is a debate over other priorities more than it is about the roads. So last year, the governor proposed a 45% or 45 cent per gallon fuel tax increase, which would have raised $2.5 billion a year. With her recommended transfers, it would have meant $1.9 billion more for roads and $600 million for other priorities. Legislators disagreed with that and instead passed a budget that included $338 million in extra transportation spending, but without a tax hike. And so this meant that there was less spending increases in other areas of the budget. And so the governor vetoed $375 million of the budget that was approved for transportation. And so despite broad bipartisan support for more road funding, the dispute over whether to raise taxes or to find revenue within growing the state's growing resources translated into a cut for the year. Now, the dispute has evolved a little bit in 2020. The governor recommended that the state borrow more money to spend on roads, and current law authorizes to do this without any further legislative approval. Though, if you guys were around for my budget presentation, you'll note that I think the Constitution requires a voter approval for new debt authorization, though there's some bad judicial interpretation about that section. Still, debt solves the wrong road problem. Debt gives the state more money now in exchange for less money in the future, plus interest expenses. It drains resources for the roads rather than increases them. Now, debt can increase road quality in the near term at the expense of road quality in the long term. In addition, short-term cash doesn't get you as much right now when road builders are already struggling to expand their operations to meet current recent road funding increases. The state could instead use money over a longer term, and it is longer term funding that would get us to the goal of putting roads together faster than they fall apart. And debt only makes it look like we're doing something. I don't think the show is worth it, but I guess the governor might, and previous governors from both parties have thought the same thing. So I guess the politics could possibly make sense even if the numbers don't add up. Still, the COVID-19 pandemic has changed the road funding dispute, and I really don't know how lawmakers are going to resolve this, but I've highlighted their options in the next slide. So the pandemic has some direct effects on road funding. Gas taxes are down, vehicle registration taxes are down too, but less so. This means that there is less road funding revenue than has been budgeted. And while revenue is expected to grow from there, and perhaps these taxes will recover faster than income and sales tax revenue, it will still take time to get us back to where we were. And so to bridge that gap for when revenue is back, the governor may want to issue debt. It's unclear whether she will. But the pandemic affects not just road funding, but all of Michigan fiscal policy, and lawmakers are going to have to reassess their spending priorities. Roads might simply be less important now. Lack of revenue caused legislators to reexamine where they think money should go. And we've run a road budget on less money before, as you've seen from my chart on road funding trends. There needs to be consensus about what to do, and I'm not sure they're going to get it. Consensus from our current lawmakers thus far has been hard won when there is not broad bipartisan agreement. So one of the reasons why things are in flux is due to uncertainty from the federal government about their relief plans for states. Some money has already been apportioned to states, and it contains restrictions that it can't be used to fill in for revenue losses. Now, a broad coalition of state groups, so public sector unions, local government groups, the governor, and yes, us too at the Mackinac Center, have argued that these restrictions should be lifted. And I think our lawmakers are waiting to hear back from the federal government before they make any major budget moves. Now, Congress is talking about spending even more than what they've already authorized. And that extra may include money specifically for roads. That sounds strange to me because current road conditions have little to do with the pandemic, but it's a topic under discussion in Washington. Now, for you guys, however, who may be part of this debate next year, this issue won't be going away. We'll either be one step closer to or one step further away from putting roads together faster than they fall apart. You'll be working on revenue that is increasing, though perhaps not back to pre-COVID levels. And so to summarize where we are, we've got a lot of roads. We fund them from whatever means we have. We've been spending more on them, and that's gotten us to the point where we're putting roads back together as fast as they fall apart. But the dispute over how to increase road funding has stopped us short of that point where we're improving our roads. And if you are successful in your campaigns, it will be your responsibility to try and resolve this dispute. So thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Okay, we got a bunch of questions here. First off, didn't Michigan stop transferring that $400 million to road funding after they implemented the increase a couple of years ago?
Yes, and then they added it back. So it was kind of one of these shifts that had happened. Like, as you saw from my road funding increase, it was gradual. It wasn't just like big jump in 2015 and then some more from there. It was, we found some extra money, we raised taxes, we pulled some of that extra money out of the budget, and then we added it back in later, which is, again, one of the reasons why we're up $1.6 billion in road spending, even though taxes only increased by $600 million.
How have lane miles grown compared to population? Is this a problem?
Population and lane miles have been stagnant in the state of Michigan for over 20 years now. I think there are some things that MDOT has on its wish list to add, but it's been maintaining, like, it didn't have the funds to maintain what it's got. So population's been at 10 million since the mid 90s. Our lane miles have been largely the same since then as well.
One person looking at your chart said pavement condition forecast doesn't match what you say. Roads in bad condition increase in the future.
It's a little bit, and frankly, those forecasts are their best guesses right now. When you talk with the TAMIC people, it's you know, they want more revenue, but they don't expect the pavement quality to decline in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it looked like a shift from 20% good, 40% fair to 30%.
Yeah, it's a shift good. Between good and fair, but poor stays the same.
Yeah,
and getting more good.
Okay. What is the calculated life of interstate roads, state roads, and has the calculated life increased due to industry technical advances or remained static?
So those are important questions to answer. And MDOT has its own research lab that's trying to figure out how to spend your money better. They've got something like 80 years worth of testing data on their roads that they publish online for anyone to check out. My understanding is that road quality has gotten better. Roads have gotten more expensive. So that's kind of both canceling each other out.
All right. Before I circle back to second questions from the folks who you've already had, let's just go ahead and grab the third rail of Michigan politics. Mm-hmm. About PA 51 and the way funds are allocated.
Yeah. So this is a problem that's especially difficult for legislators because there is Public Act 51, which are current distribution mechanisms. They've tried to balance out everyone's interest to create a fair funding system. But if you're just shifting money around that, it means that there are winners and there are losers, and that's tough for legislators to agree on. Sometimes, like the way that these disputes happen is if especially an executive or leadership comes down and says, you know, we really need to start making traffic a bigger factor, which is not a huge factor in our funding distributions right now. If you can start to do that, you can start to get more buy-in, but it really requires general alignment over the goals of road funding distributions. That just hasn't happened. And part of the reason for that is because, like, a lot of the people or the local road funding agencies just aren't trying to make the case that funding distributions are inequitable, even though I think some people can, especially in the Metro Detroit area where they've got like a lot of local roads carrying heavy trucks.
Haven't we put off fixing bridges for a very long time, creating a large funding deficit?
Okay, so bridges are an interesting thing because during that period where road funding was kind of stagnant, because these are long-term trends, bridge quality was actually getting better in the state of Michigan, even with funding that was nowhere near what the transportation agencies wanted it to. And that was up to the case until pretty recently. And so that trend line that I showed you for roads, it's different for bridges. And bridges are pretty expensive to replace too, as you guys probably would expect. That is projected to decline in the future, but it's currently around peak levels of road quality. It's again, more reasons why I think we're not quite there yet at the turning point, but we are very close.
If road condition is important, why not lower the weight limit currently twice most of other states?
Okay, so truck funding is very controversial. It's controversial for one major reason, which is not everyone owns a truck. So, and people know that trucks cause a lot of damage to the roads. They also pay a lot more in taxes. One of our transportation like administrators suspects that medium trucks are probably paying a fair share. Light trucks are probably paying more than their fair share, and heavier trucks aren't. Now, one of the reasons why the truck maximum limits don't matter as much is because of gross axle weighting. So it's not necessarily how heavy the whole truck is, but how much each axle is putting on the roads. Michigan does have a bunch of real super heavy trucks that other states don't have. There are other things that also affect those decisions. So if you have a big, long, heavy truck, you've got to build your bridges stronger, because what happens if there's a traffic jam on the Zilwaukee Bridge with a bunch of car haulers there? You know, same thing with a lot of other design issues that do make roads, especially our trunk line roads, more expensive. So I don't think it's a panacea. It's an important issue, an issue to consider. There's been a lot of changes on that already.
I thought the governor had already directed DOT to issue $3.5 billion in debt for roads. Has that happened?
They have the authority to issue those bonds. They have not issued those bonds. What they're going to do, like I said before, I just don't know. Kind of when this pandemic came about, I think she was prepared to start issuing them and have it be part of the 2020 budget for next year, but that's not going to happen. It might happen. It's so tough to get a feel for what these legislators are going to do, especially before the federal government makes their decisions about relief funds.
Are calculated lives based on financial depreciation or actual useful lives?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I can look into that and let you know. Send me an email and I'll get you that answered.
If we're talking road degradation, will you briefly speak as to why we use salt instead of sand? Is there a cost benefit in using salt?
Yeah, the main cost benefit of using salt is that it's the most effective way to get roads drier. And icy roads are really dangerous roads. That's the clearest explanation that I've been given. There's been a lot of interest in using salt alternatives, especially among environmental groups, because you know, salt does a lot of crazy stuff in the environment. I don't know that there's been an effective one. There's been a lot of interest in it, and there's been more interest in like a lot of cities using alternative snow and ice treatment than just salt.
I will share this perspective of someone who has lived in this part of the country and then also different points of my life lived in Kansas and Texas. You get further south where the temperatures don't get as cold, you see less of the salt and more of the sand. When you put sand on the road, you are getting grip on the ice. When you put salt down, you are more likely to melt the ice. So when you've got the colder temperatures up here. That's a reason to do that. I think one of the bills...
And we have a massive salt mine.
It was last year, 2018, that was talking about using the byproduct from sugar beets as a experiment or a pilot project as potential use for...
Yeah, and I think some of those things are in some of the MDOT's material studies. Again, they're available on the state's website for effectiveness. And our administrators care about this issue, but they also care about using tax money wisely. So if there's a good alternative, they'll be excited for it.
Yeah, one comment, sand is scary for motorcycles in spring. I can totally see that. Has Right to Work lowered the costs of road construction?
It's unclear so far, especially because there's been union issues with some of the road builders pretty recently. They have a very strange agreement. The theory, so a lot of road construction is made with federal dollars, and federal dollars come with Davis-Bacon. It's similar prevailing wage requirements. Michigan did get rid of its prevailing wage rules for state construction, and so there's some issues there. Right to Work directly shouldn't have any major effects on that, because it's about whether people can opt out of their union membership or not. Theoretically, if you have unions that are very responsive to their membership's needs, which is evident in their financial reason to that people can drop out of union membership if they don't want it, there might be some long-term effects there.
Okay, and then another comment. Beet juice lowers the freezing temperature of water to minus 20. So, yeah, I can see why they would want to try to do that. And then lastly...
And we have lots of beets.
Yes. I see piles of them in the late summer and fall driving out to see all the Midland office. Mm-hmm. Then lastly, road repair and replacement based on PACER rating, which is road condition rating.
Yes. So one of the neat things, once we start getting to this point where we're putting roads together faster than they fall apart, is that we get around this algorithm that like a lot of places are using, which is, look, we're just replacing the worst roads first. Like those roads are the priority. If we get extra money, we're rebuilding that. Well, winds up, if you're just doing only rebuild projects, it's more expensive. And if you can just do capital project maintenance, you can take a fair road and get it back into good condition and make it last a little bit longer. And that way you can defer that replacement cost to well in the future. I look forward to that point where we can start having those conversations more. I think like a lot of these county road commissions are like, look, we're just doing worse first until we get more.
Okay. One more question before we switch gears. What is the truth on our road spending versus neighboring states? If we are lower, where are those other states getting the money?
Okay. So Michigan tends to have... And it didn't cover this because it's one of these debates that might get settled this year. I'm not sure. Michigan tends to have high fuel and vehicle registration taxes and winds up having low spending. Part of the reason is because we're one of the rare states that puts sales taxes on fuel purchases. Most states just say, look, we got an excise tax. That's it. So there's a portion of fuel taxes that goes to schools and revenue sharing a little bit to the state government for general purposes. And there's been continual discussion about changing that, or at least earmarking that sales tax revenue back to transportation funds, which gets complicated because there's constitutional language about where that money goes. But that's kind of in debate. Michigan doesn't, I don't believe that Michigan is spending less, especially when you consider recent revenue increases. I think in the early 2000s we were. I would have to go back and verify that again, though.
Well, James, we appreciate all three of your presentations. You have been the workhorse of our program so far, and appreciate all of the wisdom that you've shared with our future elected leaders here.
And by the way, I want to thank you all for these questions. I like that you're asking the right questions that you should be answering. There are some tough issues that you guys are going to have to deal with, and it gives me some hope when you're asking these kind of things that you're looking at the right things. So thank you.
All right. Thanks, James. And we will now switch gears to auto insurance. We've got the big reform package that takes effect next week. And Mike Van Beek, our director of research, we will turn the microphone and the program over to you.
Okay, thanks, David. So now we know how the roads are funded. Now we need to figure out what happens when we get in an accident on those roads. So we're kind of connected to road funding in that way, but this is a very different issue politically, of course, because this is the probably the largest, most significant bipartisan bill package that has been achieved in the last 18 months. So it's a significant change that we're going through. But it is important to understand where we were and what the change is, because you're going to be hearing from constituents about the reforms. For the first time this year, they're going to come face to face with these reforms. So they will have questions. But also the forces that opposed these reforms will, I believe, try to chip away at them eventually, and probably start to do that right away. So being knowledgeable about these policies and what changed will be helpful when considering what future changes the legislature might undertake. Now, we're in a unique situation, really, for talking about auto insurance, because we have been literally trying to reform this system for 47 years, almost immediately after it was passed. There were attempts to reform the policy. I went back and looked at the Mackinac Center's MichiganVotes.org database, where we've tracked every bill that's been introduced in the legislature since 2000. And since 2001, there's been over 350 bills introduced to reform auto insurance. So it's been a really hot topic, and now we're at the other end of this, waiting for the actual changes to go into effect. Let me start on the next slide, David, if you can go to that one, with explaining the problem. The problem is very simple. We had the highest premiums in the country. You can go to the next one, which shows a graph of that. And this was the case for a long time, for at least a decade or so. Michigan and Louisiana often swap places at first and second. But the problem was clear. And the other important thing to remember about this as well is that the Michigan system of no-fault auto insurance was unique as well around the country compared to other states. So no other state had this requirement that every driver purchase an unlimited amount of personal injury protection. So when you think of that, and then you take into consideration these statewide comparisons about on average premiums, it's pretty strong evidence that the unique setup, the unique system that Michigan had, was responsible for these higher than normal premiums. And of course, this is a real problem, Dave. If you go to the next slide, when you think about Michigan's economic competitiveness, this impacts businesses as well, auto insurance does. And so we often don't think about that because it's something that impacts all of our wallets or most people's wallets in terms of having to pay for these premiums. But it has a real cost to the state in terms of economic competitiveness. The other point about no-fault insurance that often gets lost in the discussion, and you can go to the next slide, David, that this illustrates this fact is that Michigan really, in a lot of ways, doesn't have a no-fault system. We call it that. That's the, you know, the name of the policy when it was enacted. But the way that auto insurance works around the country in most states is that you get insurance in case you have injured someone else. If you've injured someone else in an accident, your insurance helps you cover any liability that you might have. No-fault auto insurance works a different way, whereby you have, when you get insurance, you're insuring yourself. So you're getting insurance to cover you in case you're injured. And the way that that system is supposed to work is that you insure yourself because you, oh, I'm sorry, I should also add, and also everyone as part of the system has to buy coverage as well. That's part of the no-fault system. As a trade-off for that, no-fault restricts people's ability to file lawsuits and to sue drivers after an accident has occurred. That's the trade-off. So everyone gets coverage, but people are restricted in their ability to sue each other. The idea back in the 70s was that this will save money and produce better outcomes for more people, because going to court is expensive and it takes time. So people will get better benefits if they've been injured in an accident, and they'll get them faster. And the courts won't have to deal with nearly as many lawsuits. And the benefits will be to drivers and to the efficiency of the system. Well, over the years, through a variety of legal rulings, mostly through the Michigan Supreme Court, those restrictions on people's ability to sue have been watered down, they've been lifted, they've been relaxed. So it now is easier, and more people qualify and are eligible to sue drivers as a result of accidents than used to be, and definitely many more than would have been eligible when lawmakers were considering establishing this no-fault system. And so what we've seen in the state is an explosion in lawsuits as a result of some of these Supreme Court decisions. And now we have a system that is no fault in name only, really, because it's sort of a hybrid system where you still maintain the ability to sue drivers, but we have this no fault forced premium coverage system in place as well. So we kind of have both, and we have to pay for both of those. And that was part of the problem as well. Or at least a contributing factor to the rising costs. Now I should say too, this particular issue was not addressed at all, really, in the reforms that were done. So this is still it is still state policy as a result of Supreme Court decisions that these restrictions on people's ability to sue are still relaxed. They're still much different than they used to be. So it's unclear as to how those standards will continue to affect the average price of premiums and how the system works. And then Dave, if you go to the next slide, these two just show Michigan's costs compared to other states. Really, when you look at the data and you look at these state comparisons, when you eliminate for all the differences that could explain some of these things, like, you know, maybe Michigan drivers are just worse drivers. Maybe it's because our roads are icy. Maybe it's because our roads are not in very good condition. You know, even when you take all these things into consideration, Michigan still just dwarfs other states in terms of the amount of money that is spent on auto insurance and spent on treating injuries from auto insurance, which is what this graph shows. This is the 10-year increase in costs to drivers as a result of accidents. And these are some of the other large no-fault states, which had significantly different results. Next slide, David. This is the, and then the last element to this question too is, you know, why are these premiums so high? Well, maybe it's insurance companies who are, tightly regulated entities and how this works, how they set their premiums, but maybe they're, found a way to gouge the public and profit and create huge profits. When you look at their actual record of auto insurance profits and the losses that they have to pay out, they didn't do very well over the last 15 years or so. This is the most recent data that I could find a couple of years ago. But for most years, auto insurance losses outpaced the premiums that were paid into the system. So auto insurance companies, some I'm sure were still in the black, but they weren't making windfall profits on the system, at least not from this data. Now, let's go into the what the reforms are, and then I will try to leave lots of time for answering questions. So the reforms are fivefold. And this is kind of a simplified version of these as well, as you might expect, because this is very complicated. But let me try to put it into explain it as simply as I can. So the big first element is what we call PIP choice. PIP is personal injury protection. That is the coverage that I talked about earlier, which is what drivers are required to purchase. And previously, they were required to purchase an unlimited amount of PIP, essentially. So if you were injured in an accident, there was no limit to the amount of benefits that you could receive. Now, moving forward, starting July 1st, for plans renewed after that, drivers are going to be able to choose a PIP plan of $250,000, $500,000, or an unlimited PIP plan, just as everyone was required to purchase previously. However, if you already have health insurance, or if you're on Medicare, you can opt to not pay for PIP at all, to opt out of that coverage altogether. If you are on Medicaid, you can choose a $50,000 PIP limit. The important thing to know about this is that there is an additional fee that many of us are familiar with related to the Michigan Catastrophics Claim Association. This fee is added on to every driver's premium. And if you choose any limit PIP plan, that fee will go to zero as well. The MCCA has already announced that they're reducing their fee, as they expect, I imagine, a good portion of drivers to choose some sort of limited plan, and so their future liability will be reduced, and so they're able to reduce their fee. The second element of the reforms is a fee schedule. This is basically a cost control system for medical care that is provided as the result of an accident. Previously, there was no fee schedule. Most publicly regulated insurance systems use fee schedules like Medicare and Medicaid. And even in the case where they aren't in use, insurance companies and agencies have the ability to negotiate for rates and things like that. Auto insurers weren't able to do that. And so what happened was, medical providers with no sort of hard limit on what they could charge. This is why we saw evidence of medical providers charging 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much for similar procedures as a result of an auto accident compared to some other injury. This was something that Mayor Dugan harped on a lot when he was testifying on this issue and pushing for reform. Of course, he could draw on his personal experience at the DMC, and he was a very powerful advocate for reining in and creating some kind of cost control system. So that's what that fee schedule does. It is based on federal health program systems. So it's the legislature doesn't have to set these costs at any rate. It's just benchmarked to a federal cost schedule. Another element is premium reductions. Insurers are required by law to reduce their premiums, and only reduced premiums can be approved by the state. The fourth element is ratings restrictions. This is kind of the wild card in the bunch, I think, of the reforms. It's really hard to know what kind of impact this is going to have. So the ratings restrictions are insurance companies pool drivers together to create premium levels and to create an efficient way of providing coverage to groups of people. And they use a variety of factors to determine what those rates should be. The new law says that insurance companies cannot consider a driver's gender, marital status, home ownership, credit score, education level, occupation, or zip code when they are setting those ratings. This is, to my knowledge, from the research that I've done, this is the most restrictive set of rating restrictions in the country. There's only a handful of other states that really regulate this, and those ratings restrictions are actually much similar to the ones that Michigan used to have. But now we've gone a little farther. And so because this is kind of new territory, it's really hard to predict what the impact of this will be. There's also been consideration that these might not be as effective as what they could be as the way that they're written into the law. So it's really hard to tell. The fifth element is an anti-fraud system. I expect that this will, again, this is hard to judge what the impact of this will be. Obviously there's fraud in the system. To the extent that this helps ferret it out, that's great. But it's really difficult to say how much of that fraud exists and how effective this kind of program to get rid of it will actually be. So that was auto insurance, 47 years worth of policy reform effort in 20 minutes, roughly. So that's pretty good. But let me take your questions and...
Okay. First question, can you please repeat the restriction categories?
Yes. Gender, marital status, occupation, zip code, home ownership, credit score, and education level.
Okay. And on premium reductions, they would be allowed by whom from the state?
The Department of Insurance is the one who has to improve those. Premium rates. So the insurance companies have to submit them to the state, and the state has to approve them.
Does the zip code restriction eliminate all geographic-based ratings?
That's a good question, and that's one of the reasons why we don't know what the impact of this is going to be, because we don't know if that really is going to be a big impact or not. If there's other ways to use geography besides zip code. It's hard to say, maybe not. And so there's a real question about how effective that's going to be.
Yeah. While waiting to see if any more questions come in on insurance, I'll just share my example of coming into Michigan from another state, Texas, where I lived before. I had, Texas was top 10 most expensive auto insurance state, and it got my attention when the week I moved up here, I had my auto insurance come up for renewal, and I stayed with the same company, and merely changing my zip code from a Texas zip code to a Michigan zip code, my auto insurance premium increased 73%. And so as I was trying to figure out, okay, well, why is it so much more expensive here? It's like, oh, you've got all these other benefits. And it's like, well, what if I would rather take a little bit of risk on myself and save money and be able to use it for other things? Like, no, you've got to have this unlimited personal injury protection in the event you are the one in 10,000 or 100,000 in a particular year. I forget what the math is, that you're in a horrible auto accident and you run through the maximum on your personal injury protection. I went under the new law, and because our health insurance does coordinate the benefits, I was able to opt out of PIP. My renewal, even after I increased several of my bodily injury coverage and reduced deductible on collision and increased the rental car reimbursement, my new premium is 62% less. I'm paying less than I would if I still lived in Texas.
The other thing I should add too is, and congratulations, David, we're all really happy for you, you saved money, but yes, that might not be everybody's experience mm-hmm. as a result of the law. So as we've already mentioned, we don't know what the result of the ratings restrictions will be. But also the other factor is that for a long time, because everyone was required to buy a certain level of coverage, there wasn't as much room for auto insurers to offer various plans and options and really kind of match the right level of coverage to individuals. So, you know, you might save money on your medical coverage through PIP, but then, you know, you might spend that right back to get better collision coverage. And so what you might spend the same on auto insurance, but you've actually got more coverage for, you know, more things that you care about having coverage for. So that's the other thing, is that each individual's experience with this is going to be different. And some people aren't going to save money. And it's, you know, I'm sure they'll be very frustrated, but that will be the reality.
Yeah. The zip code restriction, I'm told, was replaced by census tract. I guess they're coming up with a different type of geographic.
Yeah.
Okay. Some residents state that they want to keep the unlimited option because they don't see any benefit on the multiple medical coverage options, but instead it would be more expensive for them to choose something else if they change it. Would it be the case? Can somebody opt out from the catastrophic fund?
Well, you can opt out of the catastrophic fund if you opt out of unlimited PIP coverage. That's the way that you would do that. I don't think you can do unlimited PIP and not pay into the MCCA. So it is true, even though people will have an opportunity to purchase unlimited PIP, which, by the way, I still don't know if that is offered anywhere else in the country, if other insurance companies even give drivers the ability to purchase that amount of coverage. Mm-hmm. You'll still be able to get it, but it is right. It will most certainly be more expensive, mm-hmm. Because previously those costs were spread over every driver, and now those costs are going to be shared just amongst people who have purchased that plan.
How and when will we know if this will have an effect on the percentage of uninsured motorists?
We don't actually have good data on uninsured motorists, as you might imagine. They don't come and let themselves be counted very easily. So we just have estimates. The ones that I consider the best are an estimate that 20% of Michigan drivers were uninsured, and that the highest that I saw that I think is reliable is 40% of drivers in Detroit were uninsured. So since we don't, it's really hard to say, but it should definitely come down. I mean, you know, just common sense says that's going to happen if the price of these premiums go down. And I repeatedly tell people there are definitely trade-offs in this policy decision and the way that this works, but some insurance is better than no insurance. So even if we have, even if people are buying a plan that you don't think has enough coverage, for many people, the alternative is no coverage. And then they have nothing when they get an accident. So some is always better than none when it comes to insurance.
Okay. What sort of effect do you think there will be as far as if you're taking the medical claims out of auto insurance and putting them onto group health insurance?
Yeah, that's that great question. And that was a topic of debate during the reform. And that is the reason why, or the rationale for why Medicaid recipients can't go all the way down to zero PIP. That's why they have to, their lowest limit is 50,000. And part of the rationale for that was that would prevent some of those costs from being moved onto these different systems. I think David, you said in the chat box there, a lot of people have coordination of benefits, which means that when you're in an auto accident now, many people have already told their auto insurer and their medical insurer that they want to bill their medical insurer first. The reason they do that is because you can get a cheaper premium because there are cost controls and a variety of other reasons why that would be less expensive. So because that's already the case for a lot of people, the impact of having more people get coverage through their health insurer as a result of an accident is probably not going to be significant. And especially if it's in a federal program, it's so large that it's probably not going to make a difference one way or the other that we'll notice.
Yeah, there was a table that Mayor Duggan showed in one of his presentations to the Senate committee that was dealing with auto insurance, where he compared the rates that were charged by Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance, and in the automotive PIP, because PIP didn't have a negotiated fee schedule. It was reasonable and customary charges. And pretty much across the board, you saw the charges in the auto insurance claims being four and a half times what even private insurance was charging. So, you know, yes, you do have a shift in where it's going to be paid for, but as you said, the cost controls are going to be, you know, more reasonable.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, it is 9:30. Actually, one last final question of the evening. How much of losses are personal injury versus property?
Good question. I don't know, but I could probably find that for you. So,
I remember the personal injury. That was another slide in the Mayor Duggan presentation. That PIP had grown from, at the time that it was, at the time that the law was passed in the 70s, the medical coverage was 7% of the auto insurance premium. As of, I think, 2018, it was 42%.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is why opting out of PIP is such a huge, huge you know, cost savings, or at least that's my experience. So, all right. Thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight. Our final class is on Thursday at 8:30. We hope that all of you will be with us, and we'll have all of this information on the Candidate University website tomorrow. Have a good night, everyone.